Welcome to this week's Investors Chronicle Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Lenora Walters, and joining me today are Kate Bailey, Deputy Personal Finance Editor, Emma Ajimang, Personal Finance Writer, and special guest Stephen Peters, Investment Trust Analyst at Charles Stanley. Now, you're probably familiar with emerging markets and all the risks and opportunities that come with these, but you might not be so well acquainted with frontier markets. These underdeveloped markets also offer potential for growth, and in some cases better than that which emerging markets offer. So not surprisingly, some investors are turning to this area. Emma, you've been assessing the potential of frontier markets. So first of all, what exactly are they and how do they compare to emerging markets?
Well, as you say, Leonora, the main difference is that they are less well-developed markets and economies. So they are still considered emerging markets, but because they are substantially less advanced than, you know, emerging markets like, you'd say, China and other countries like that, we call them frontier markets. So as well as having smaller economies, they also have smaller stock markets, less well-developed, and trade as much on them.
Okay. Now, they offer opportunities for growth and in some cases higher than emerging markets. Why are they so growthy? What's the potential there?
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's another number of reasons. I mean, many of these countries tend to be sort of resource rich, and they've also got great demographics in the fact that they tend to have young populations and, you know, dynamic young people who want to get on. So if the country is, you know, investment is coming into the country and there is employment opportunities, that's going to sort of drive growth. And then also just the fact that they're starting from a much less well-developed point, that means that they've got a lot further to grow and a lot further to go, but also a lot further to grow. So if investors get in at that early point, that they can sort of take part in the journey that from, you know, less well-developed country to hopefully developed, fully fledged developed economy in the years to come.
Okay, so starting from a much lower base in emerging markets then. So what will be some examples of frontier markets?
Well, you know, these countries are scattered all the way around the globe, really. So you've got, you know, markets in Eastern Europe, for example. Those are considered frontier markets. And you've also got markets in South America, in Africa, and in Asia. So really, you know, you can take your pick in terms of regions. Most regions will have some very less well-developed countries which are considered frontier markets.
Which countries?
Say, for example, Nigeria is one sort of big frontier market that's been talked about a lot, obviously in Africa. And then we've got places like Vietnam, which is a big market lots of people are getting excited about because they've got a very big population, young population, quite well educated. So there's lots of pluses in that area. Argentina is another market that investors are very interested in. And so, yeah, there's quite a few.
Okay. Now, it all sounds good, but where you get high growth potential, you tend to get some high risks as well.
Yes,
so what are the downsides of the risks?
Well, as you point out, Leonora, there's a number. I mean, as well as the fact that you are just investing in a less well-developed economy, there's lots of sort of issues with, I mean, infrastructure, like there's also issues in terms of political risks. Some of these countries are, you know, not particularly democratic. Problems of corruption, some of them, less well-developed legal systems. These are all problems that could affect investors. And there's also the issue of currency risks. So many of these countries have volatile currencies, and if their currency weakens substantially, then any sort of gain that you might have got from returns is effectively lost. So there's a number of things to consider.
Okay, but I suppose similar to the risks you get in emerging markets.
I suppose, I mean, the other thing with frontier markets is that because they have less well-developed stock markets, it might be harder to kind of to exit and sell your holdings.
Okay.
And emerging markets are much more
traded.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's harder to get into and also out of frontier markets.
Okay. Now, bearing all that in mind, what kind of investors are frontier markets suitable for? And these investors, what percentage of their portfolios could you consider committing to the region?
Well, obviously, this is about as high risk as you can get. So it's got to be for investors who have a long-term focus, mm-hmm. at least 5 years, preferably 10 years or more. And people who are able to stomach high risk. Very high risk sort of focused investors. And the analyst that we spoke to suggested that, you know, it needs to be a very small part of your portfolio for the reasons that it is quite a risky area. So under 5% is what I suggest.
Okay. Now, if you don't have a high enough risk appetite to put your money into a dedicated frontier markets fund, are there sort of other ways where maybe you could get a bit of exposure?
Yes, definitely. And that's definitely a valid point. If you don't want to sort of stomach the risk, I mean, for example, you could, you know, consider just investing in some global emerging markets funds, because frontier markets are sort of included in emerging market funds. I mean, some funds will
go
still have
benchmark.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, you can look at yeah. whether that's the case in those funds. That's a way of doing it. And then there's also, you can also sort of invest directly in companies that are themselves investing in these regions.
Okay.
So, for example, companies that are investing in Vietnam or building factories or
maybe,
you know,
listed
exactly.
in the UK or
listed
something.
Listed in the UK.
Yeah.
Or,
but yeah, involved in the frontier markets.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's another way to do it.
Now, Stephen, what are your thoughts on investing in frontier markets funds?
I'd agree with a lot of what's been said already. I'd make a couple of points as well, which I think are often overlooked. And one is that a lot of these frontier market companies that you'll see in some of the bigger, more well-known funds and trusts are often come out of state-owned. They usually have to be state-owned. And a lot of them are aware that outside investors have concerns over corporate governance that comes with investing in frontier markets. So what you often find, which people overlook, is that some of them do pay quite interesting dividend yields. So we're going to talk about maybe a couple of the trusts in your article, or a couple of funds and trusts in your article. But so BlackRock Frontier Markets, the investment trust, that has a dividend yield of 3.5%, which is not what you would expect from what is a high growth investment class or asset class. I would agree that it's risky. You can mitigate that risk in a couple of ways. You can own a small part of it. You take, for argument's sake, whatever you're prepared to invest in emerging markets within your portfolio, take away 20% of that, say, and invest it in a small way in frontier markets. I'd also point out for those listeners who do buy investment trusts that there are a couple of frontier market investment trusts. The discounts on those do wax and wane a little bit, and you can enhance your returns, mitigate your risk by buying those trusts when they're trading at wider discounts to asset value.
You mentioned BlackRock Frontier Markets Investment Trust. Are there any other funds that you would mention for getting exposure to this area?
I very much prefer closed-ended funds for illiquid asset classes such as this. Investment trusts have their strengths. They're not brilliant in all asset classes and in all asset types, but in illiquid equity portfolios, they are excellent because there's a fixed pool of capital that the manager can invest, and he or she, in the case of these trusts, there's a he and a she running this vehicle. They don't have to worry about the money coming in and out, the flows, the sentiment waxes and wanes. As somebody reads an article, oh, I'm going to invest in some of that, and then, you know, asset flows rush in, and then equally when sentiment falls, money flies out. So closed-ended vehicle, very, very useful tool for that. There's two investment trusts, really, the BlackRock Frontier Markets Trust and one that is now titled, it's run by a small company within Aberdeen Asset Management. That is more of a fund of funds, fund of funds typically come with more expenses. They're more costly.
Is that the Advance Frontier?
What was formerly known as Advance.
Yeah, what's it called now?
Well, it's Aberdeen something, I can't remember exactly what its name is.
Probably Frontier Markets.
Almost certainly.
Yeah.
As you can tell, I don't really follow it because it is a fund of funds.
Yeah.
This is a long-term asset class fees are important. Mm. Whilst the BlackRock fee fund is not the most, good value, it's not cheapest in the headline cost, I think it's the better vehicle. It's directly into frontier markets equities within a closed-ended structure.
Okay, and you can see some more fun suggestions in Emma's article if you think you're brave enough to explore the final frontier. Now, IC Top 100 fund Baillie Gifford Shin Nippon may in theory focus on the extreme opposite to what we've been discussing, Japan, a developed market. But its recently appointed manager is very interested in under-the-radar small companies, which he says have a lot of development and growth potential. Kate, you recently met with Baillie Gifford Shin Nippon's manager, Praveen Kumar. So can you explain what these companies are that he argues will help this investment trust to continue delivering its strong returns?
Yeah, well, he basically divided Japan into Old Japan and New Japan. And we're saying that Old Japan are the kind of companies that we maybe think of as being quite slow, kind of lumbering giants of companies, and he's saying there's now a new wave of entrepreneurialism coming to the country, and there's this kind of new generation of young disruptive stocks which are really exciting, and which you probably wouldn't have heard of, but are tapped into some of these big global trends like driverless cars and the Internet of Things, all of those kind of aspects. And actually the trust has been delivering amazing returns, kind of making the most of those trends already, and there seems that there's some quite exciting potential in small caps over there.
Now, is some investing in that kind of thing, is that a new direction for the trust?
It's kind of a continuation of what the trust was doing before, but obviously he has just taken over, and he's quite keen to keep pushing that, and particularly on the area of healthcare. Wants to really build that out for disruptive healthcare stocks is a particular area of interest for him. But no, this is a theme that the trust has been using for a while.
Some of the companies that they had for a while have actually got rather large. Can we say that Baillie Gifford Shin Nippon is still a smaller companies fund?
Well, I did ask this because obviously they're talking about, or he was talking about, these stocks that have, you know, appreciated kind of double digits. Or appreciated a lot.
Was that Monotaro,
yeah, for example? The obvious question is, are you now just holding a load of large stocks? And in fact, no, he isn't. And the trust is still majority held in Topic's small companies. But some of them have grown a little larger. He says his sell discipline he doesn't sell when stocks reach a certain market cap. It's all about how much growth potential stocks have. I mean, if you look at the breakdown of the trust, it definitely is still a smaller company's trust. But there is no question that he is forced to sell something just because it gets larger.
Okay. Now, you also recently spoke to another Baillie Gifford manager, James Anderson, who runs Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust, and he also seems to be looking for entrepreneurial smaller companies, in particular unlisted ones. So is this a bit of a house theme at Baillie Gifford, and are the managers all following it?
Yeah, well, this kind of search for disruptive companies is a bit of a house theme, and I guess it is quite a kind of... a lot of people are talking about it all across the asset management industry, but Baillie Gifford have been following it very successfully for a while. And I guess it's just this idea that you find companies which are going to be the real fast-growing ones of the future and really shaking up major industries where there is not that much growth left. And the idea is that you can find these kind of disruptive stocks or unlisted companies all, you know, across different sectors. So people often think of things like Scottish Mortgage as a tech fund, and Baillie Gifford would say, look, this isn't technology specific, this is just the fact that we're finding companies which have the ability to change industries.
Stephen, what do you think about Baillie Gifford Shin Nippon investing in these kinds of smaller company?
Well, just to clarify, Shin Nippon does actually mean New Japan in Japanese, I'm told, by Baillie Gifford. So that is the name tells you exactly what it's going to do. This is a good trust. This is another example where the closed-ended fund structure is advantageous to investors. It allows Baillie Gifford to identify young up-and-coming companies, invest in them for the long term, free of worrying about flows in and out of the fund. There is actually a similar open-ended fund run by Legg Mason, Shoizumi Asset Management, which has very, very good returns, has been stupendous in the last year or so, but this is open-ended and is subject to investor sentiment waxing and waning. I like this trust. It is a house theme, this technology theme. Big solutions to big problems is a catchy phrase that I hear used in Baillie Gifford around the world. The other investment trust, Edinburgh Worldwide, does this on a global basis. So this is just a small cap Japan fund, Edinburgh Worldwide kind of small cap global fund. It's a really interesting fund. It's performed amazingly in the absence of any other kind of areas of growth within the Japanese market. Large caps have really struggled in recent times, hence funds and managers that have focused on smaller companies, mid-sized companies such as Baillie Gifford, have done very, very well. So there are risks, and we'll talk about those maybe in a second, but for the long-term investor, this is a very, very interesting trust.
Okay, picking up on the risk, do you think that, looking at these kind of small upstart companies that, might do well, but might, not survive, do you think that will increase the risk of Baillie Gifford Shin Nippon?
Risk is an interesting. What is risk? Those three words have spawned books and academic articles, around the world for many years. Baillie Gifford would argue that risk is not owning big, large cap companies and just sitting on the benchmark. Risk to them is not owning companies that can grow exponentially. And they show some quite interesting statistics across their fund range, or some of their funds, Scottish Mortgage, Edinburgh Worldwide, where they show that their big winners, the funds that grow up 10, 20 times in price, such as Monotaro, such as M3, stocks like that, the amount of money they make from those far outweighs the money they may lose from the riskier things that fail. So that's what they're looking for. They're looking for asymmetry or asymmetric returns. They're looking for their big winners to far outweigh the losses from their losers.
Okay, it's almost what private equity managers do.
You talked about Scottish Mortgage. This isn't about Scottish Mortgage, but Scottish Mortgage are doing exactly that. Yeah. I mean, we're recording this on the day when Scottish Mortgage's annual report and accounts came out. Scottish Mortgage is looking to put up to 25% of their portfolio into unlisted, and they're fully aware, and they are quite open about it. Some of their investments will fail. Undoubtedly, they do not have a monopoly on being right. What they do think is they're buying reasonably developed but unlisted companies that haven't needed to come to the stock market for capital. And hopefully when they do sell, come to the market, whatever, then they'll make big gains. This is what they did with Alibaba a number of years ago.
Talking of speculative elements of this trust, the manager Pravin Kumar only took over the running in December. Do you think he can emulate the strong returns of its previous manager, John McDougall?
I think there's an important point here, and I think I mentioned this in my last podcast that I did with you, that you have to kind of separate the manager's skill and the returns of the market. Small cap, mid cap growth in Japan over the last 5 or 6 years has been the area to be in. Every manager with that kind of investment style has done well. So John McDougall has gone off to do bigger things within Baillie Gifford. He's very, very highly regarded there. Praveen, I've met. We will see if he does a good job. If Japanese markets, Japanese equities are down 30%, he's not going down by probably less than 30%. That's not his fault. It's just a function of the asset class he's investing in.
But you'd hope he'd outperform a bit.
Not in those markets. Yeah. The Baillie Gifford style is that probably if the broad market over a year is down by X, they will be down probably by more than that figure.
Okay.
That's just the way it is. That's not really a manager flaw. Mm. It's just the investment style they adopt. They're betting on the fact that when markets are going up, they will go up by more.
A lot more. Okay. Okay, so high octane stuff. And you can read Kate's full interview with Pravin Kumar in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Now, over the last couple of calendar years, there's been a steady stream of new investment trust launches, most notably last year's whopping $800 million issue from Woodford Patient Capital Trust, which high-profile manager Neil Woodford runs. But so far in 2016, there haven't been any investment trust initial public offerings, or IPOs for short. This hasn't been the case since the first quarter of 2009, just after the financial crisis, when there were also no investment trust IPOs. But Stephen, we haven't just emerged from a crisis, so why have there been no investment trust IPOs this year?
It's a really interesting question, and one that's being asked quite widely. I think there was an interesting or there was a relevant piece of work done looking at the open-ended fund world recently, where it showed that this first quarter of 2016 has been a dreadful quarter for new fund flows coming into open-ended funds. So clearly what's happening is that there is massive investor uncertainty about the direction of markets, about interest rates. So is the US going to raise rates or cut them? Is China going to have a hard landing, soft landing? All these usual questions. And quite simply, investors have kept their wallets closed. They've sat on their hands and not invested in open-ended funds and in investment trusts. The investment trust community have made money. The kind of the investment trust brokers have made good money for themselves over the last couple of years from these new launches. There have been one or two, and we'll talk about one in a minute, that that tried and failed. It's simply because they're not offering something that is sufficiently attractive to us as fund buyers to recommend to our clients.
Okay, so it's a funds industry-wide problem, not just an investment trust thing. One issue which I will bring up that some other people mentioned was Brexit. I mean, you talked about general market uncertainty. Some people were specifically saying, well, they're waiting to see what the vote is. If we stay in, if they go ahead, if we come out, who knows what's going to happen. Do you think it's you know, a big issue, and maybe as much as some of the others you mentioned, like US interest rates and wider sort of global market issues?
Brexit is definitely an issue. I think it's a broader and much more serious issue than just investment trusts in terms of regulation and the regulatory burden affecting the asset management industry and what they would and would not be able to sell to UK investors should we decide to leave the European Union. And I won't get more boring than that, but it is relevant. From an investment trust perspective, discounts are widening. Markets always hate uncertainty. We had this last year with the election, the general election, where discounts in the UK trusts widened going into May. And then when we had the result, then they narrowed. That is again happening this year. There's other factors. Large caps are outperforming small caps this year. But with all of that, discounts are widening. I would not be surprised to see a discount narrowing across the sector post June the 23rd.
Okay. Now, you mentioned some, let's say, attempts. Yeah, there was at least one attempt to launch an investment trust a couple of months ago, the Healthcare Royalty Trust. Now, this actually seemed rather attractive. It was, you know, offering potentially high yield and high returns. I mean, why did it fail to come? I would have thought investors would be piling into that kind of thing.
There was definitely a sense of investor fatigue. Oh, it's yet another high income, low growth investment trust coming to us from a US manager trying to raise money in the UK listed funds market. It was a perfectly sensible and a perfectly attractive opportunity. My understanding is that one large investor said, we really like the idea, but we don't want to buy it in listed form. We don't want to buy an investment trust. We will give you the money and you can run money for us on a segregated basis. And I think that touches on some relevant concerns that people should have about closed-ended funds, which is that liquidity can come and go. And because trusts can trade at discounts, people don't necessarily want to buy something and then see sentiment change towards it, and then a discount widens from a premium to a discount, and then you know you've lost 15% of your money, and nothing's actually happened. That's just market sentiment. I think that's a point. Plus, you know, we've had so much fundraisings in the last few years, be it wind farms or loans or you know SME lending or infrastructure funds. All of these things, so many different things. People just went, do you know what? Don't really need this one.
Yeah, which brings me on to my next point. It's maybe on the surface surprising that there aren't many, you know, or there aren't any IPOs. But actually, is it a bad thing? I mean, do we need more investment trusts?
Well, in your article, there's a very interesting stat from Numis, which I wasn't aware of, which is essentially 2/3 of investment trust launches since 2000 have failed. And there's you know things to talk about that. But do we need new investment trusts? No. Do we need fewer of the ones that already exist? Yes, we do need consolidation. But what you want is you want capital recycling into better opportunities. What you don't want is further me too copycat launches coming in because somebody's just trying to jump on a bandwagon. You don't want them coming in charging investors exorbitant fees. You don't want them having
boards and board directors who are just in it for the money and are maybe not the highest quality board directors that can provide the oversight to, and control on the management companies that really need. And you want funds that are really doing something that offer us as fund buyers something we can't already get. But again, don't overcharge us, because there is no investment trust has a divine right to A, raise money, and B, exist once it has done.
Okay. And just turning to another point about IPOs, even when they do come, you mentioned, you know, the kind of influence of some of these big asset managers, big investors. How easy is it generally for small private investors, such as Reed Investors Chronicle, to take part in an IPO if and when it comes, and if and when they think it's suitable for them?
It's possible. It may be, interestingly, Healthcare Royalty Trust did have a they teamed up with one of these fintech companies that was trying to make it easier for private investors to invest in IPOs, which obviously that didn't go ahead. But it is possible. One can do it through just finding a copy of the prospectus, filling in the form on the back, sending your check off. You can do it through platforms and private client brokers. Obviously, I work for one, so you could do it through us if you wish. But it's possible, but always take a step back and say, do I want this? Is there a reason why it's being launched at the market now? Typically, investment trust launches are quite cyclical. So clearly you launch a fund when the asset class it is at its most attractive, most favourable. That's usually after all of the excellent performance has come rather than before.
So arguably when it's not attractive because it may be expensive.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Yeah. So you've got to be careful. You've got to understand the difference between, is this a long-term growth story? Is this just an income play? And if so, what are you paying? You might be getting a 6% dividend yield, but if you're paying 1.5% in fees, question, can I get that level of income somewhere else for less?
Okay, some really useful advice there. Thanks for that. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. So it just remains to thank Stephen Peters, investment analyst at Charles Stanley, Investors Chronicle, deputy personal finance editor Kate Bailey, and personal finance writer Emma Ajimang. You can read more on Frontier Markets, Bailey Gifford Shin Nippon, and investment trust IPOs in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle and the website. Thank you for listening and have a good weekend.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.